I'm Dave Miller. This is Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC, coming to you today from a very quiet Oregon Capitol. It's quiet because lawmakers ended their often contentious 2017 session on Friday. They've all returned to their respective corners of the state, but Oregon Governor Kate Brown is still here, and she joins me now. Thanks very much for having us in your ornamental office here.
We're just delighted to have you here.
So let's start with what I was talking about in the first half of the show, the ongoing debate between the business community and many Republican lawmakers on one side and unions and many Democrats on the other. This is one of those cases where they all seem to want, in the end, the same basic thing. I mean, they want a thriving state on a sustainable fiscal path. They want good jobs. They want a good education system. They have very different ideas about how to get there. What room for compromise do you see?
Well, I would just say for a couple of things. Number one, I have been in this building on and off for the last 20-plus years fighting for adequate and stable revenue for key essential services. This has been an issue that Oregon governors and Oregon legislatures have struggled with for multiple decades. There are two things that I think have changed in the last 20 years that make it more difficult to achieve consensus. One is that we now require a supermajority vote in the legislature to get a revenue measure through. And then secondly, we now have a pattern, or there are prior incidences of when the legislature does pass a revenue measure, it gets referred to the voters. So not only do you have to meet an 18 in the Senate and a 36 in the House, you have to be able to be successful with the Oregon electorate. So
remind folks, in terms of the 18 and 36, Democrats right now are very close, but they're one seat away, one vote away in each chamber to get that three-fifths supermajority.
Yes. So not control all of those votes. So that is challenging. I think there's been one session in the last 25 years that a party has controlled both chambers with supermajorities. So it's an unusual thing for it to happen. So it requires bipartisan support. I think the transportation package that we were able to put together and get across the finish line is a great model. So following the 2015 legislative session, I put together a transportation visioning panel, toured around the state, a group of business folks, elected officials, and community leaders designed to hear from Oregonians what they wanted to see in a transportation package. We took that information and the priorities of Oregonians, essentially gave it to the Joint Legislative Committee on Transportation, and they developed a package that has been able to get broad support in the building. I think we can do something like that, something similar to that during this interim. I think we can and we must. The business community has said they believe they need to pay more. I've had multiple conversations, both with individual members, Greg Ness of the Standard, and my good friend Patrick Kreitzer from Tillamook Creamery. But I've also had conversations with organizations, the Technology Association of Oregon. They are willing to step up to the plate and pay more.
But what are the contours? I know that you're often, and people in your position are loath to give specifics about a deal when you're in sort of the early stages. But what are the basic contours of a compromise that you can imagine? And the reason it seems so challenging is just to reference the last conversation we had. I mean, on the one hand, you have the business community who says, we don't like the way Democrats and unions have been talking about raising revenue, the model of a gross receipts tax. We simply don't think that the model that Democrats seem focused on right now is a good one at all. On the other hand, you have labor unions who say, we're not sure that we're going to support any decreases to public employee benefits that penalizing, they would say, current and young employees for some of the generosity of the past, that's the wrong way to go. They seem so far apart. What model do you see to bring them close?
Well, I think that is the challenge. We certainly struggled to bring folks together during the legislative session. I think coming away from the building, having individual conversations with both individual members of different communities, the labor community, the business community, and legislators, they very much have to be a part of this conversation. I think the discussions that happened during the legislative session provide at least move the ball down the field, if I can use a sports analogy. it has given us a framework in terms of what might be possible. If it's not, you know, there were certainly multiple proposals, both the Haas proposal, Senator Haas's proposal, and the Speaker's proposal. That gives us some parameters of what might work. The other challenge, as he mentioned, was the cost containment. And Democrats stepped up to the plate this legislative session with the passage of Senate Bill 1067, a bipartisan, collaborative piece of legislation that will save several hundred million dollars in the next biennium. I think there's more work to be done. We're going to continue to tighten our belts and look at how we can deliver services more effectively and efficiently. And the other piece of that is PERS. They all need to come together, right? And the challenge is, how do you do that? So we're taking the next couple of weeks, talking with folks, seeing who we can bring to the table, but I'm going to set the table and make sure that we have a strategy in place as we move into the next biennium.
Next biennium, meaning the next long legislative session. Why not try to just do some magic a year from now in the short legislative session?
Magic takes heat. I will tell you.
Is that a rule? Magic takes heat.
a special session. I think a lot depends upon what happens at the federal level. The Trump administration and what happens with the budget on the health plan, what happens on taxes, that could impact whether or not we would be forced to come into the building for a special session. That obviously would create the heat to force people to come in the building. I don't think we want to waste taxpayer dollars by coming in on a special session if we don't have the votes lined up and the plan ready to rock and roll.
How do you feel about the initiative petitions that that are already out there that could very well become ballot measures? One of them would be a slightly different version of a gross receipts tax coupled with a slight decrease in personal income tax. Another would get rid of, at least for education funding, the requirement for a supermajority vote to increase funding if it's going to go to education. I mean, that's something that, that you'd pointed to as a problem. Would you support these ballot measures if they are on the ballot?
At this point in time, I'm focused on figuring out a way if we can bring the labor community, the business community, and legislators to the table to work out a proposal that would have the agreement of the vast majority of the parties involved. That's going
like
to take a lot of work. I know that. But the lesson we learned from ballot measure 97 is if we are in the throes of a ballot measure, it was impossible to get folks to the table to have serious conversations. These ballot measures, they've just been filed within the last couple of weeks. They have to go through the ballot title process, so they're a long way off from becoming a reality. So we have the time now to have the conversations needed to see if we can reach a consensus on a particular proposal or a slate of options for the legislature to consider.
If I understand you correctly, and I know that you're being careful about this, and these are, you know, these are your political supporters in a lot of ways who are pushing for these measures, but it sounds like you're saying, please don't do this. I agree with a lot of things you're trying to do, but the way you're going to go about this with these ballot measures is not going to accomplish what you want. I mean, is that a fair way to put it?
I would say that's too premature in terms of my position, but I think we are tired of the ballot measure strategy. I think we saw this with ballot measure 97. It's time to see if we can really get people to a table and tackle the long-term structural deficit issues that Oregon faces.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking right now with Oregon Governor Kate Brown. We're coming to you from the Capitol. Let's turn to the transportation package, which you had mentioned was something that you're both proud of and you see as a model for the two sides coming together to accomplish something. A couple weeks ago, when the original version of the transportation package, a bigger version, when that sort of hit the rocks, did you think you were going to get a bill passed?
I was committed to making sure we would pass a transportation package.
That's different than saying you thought it was going to happen, though.
I will say that I was cautiously optimistic we were still going to get it done. What happened was that we had buy-in from legislators in the metropolitan area, from urban, from rural Oregon, all across the state. We had four committed legislators from both sides of the aisle that were very anxious and very very committed to getting this done. We also had a number of legislators throughout the building who see this as a win for Oregon. It was the most comprehensive, probably one of the more innovative transportation packages that we've seen in the state probably ever. And in addition, one of the side benefits is we're going to see creation of over 16,000 jobs as a result of the construction activities.
There's money in the transportation package for things like public transportation, for pedestrian and biking infrastructure, but the majority of it goes to driving, to making it easier for cars to, you know, zoom along or at least putter along on Oregon roads. And that's something that people who are very focused on carbon emissions have said is a problem, that if you're going to spend billions of dollars in a way that's going to, in the end, just make it easier for people to drive around, you're not addressing climate change, something that you have said is one of your priorities. How do you respond to that basic argument?
Well, there are a couple of pieces. Number one, it is absolutely imperative that we invest in ensuring that our road system is resilient and is preserved for the future, for future generations. When I mean by resilient, that means making sure that it can withstand a Cascadia subduction zone event. We want to make sure that we invest in our roads and bridges in a way that makes sense for Oregon. And a great example, and I was down in Medford a couple of months ago touring, I've toured the Medford Viaduct in a Cascadia subduction event. It would literally crumble, and it would cut off that part of the region, which is a really critical economic region for Oregon. So this package invests in at least phase two of the Medford Viaduct in a way that I think will promote resiliency. In terms of the environmental side, the comprehensive nature of the transit is significant. It is the first time ever that the state of Oregon has invested in a public transit. As I've been around to every single community around the state and the transportation visioning panel toured, and I know the legislative committees went on tour, communities around the state said, we need public transit. And to say that $1.3 billion investment, that is huge. It would allow areas like the Portland metropolitan area to stabilize transit during a recession. It will allow for communities to invest in transit in a way that will enable people to get to work and job training opportunities and educational opportunities. I really see public transit as a vehicle to lift families out of poverty.
You were talking about setting the table for the 2019 legislative session so they can do something that's eluded a lot of previous governors in doing a big rejiggering of both the tax system and the public employee retirement system. What about something like climate change? What about putting a price on carbon? I mean, is that something that you would put a significant portion of your own political capital on in the coming years?
So I want to go back to the transportation package, because the other thing that's innovative and creative about the package is the investments in an electrical vehicle rebate program that includes dedicated low-income rebates. I think that is also a message saying this is how we want to move to the future, and I think it is quite creative. So in terms of carbon pricing, there was legislation introduced on cap and invest this session. There's also been a really interesting report sponsored by the Nature Conservancy, working very closely with the business community about how we can continue to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. I see cap and invest as a critical component of that strategy, and I am committed to moving forward on it. It has to be part of a regional strategy, obviously California, Washington. I think we have to do it in a way that doesn't further harm struggling Oregon families. It has to be done equitably, and it has to be done in a way that continues to ensure that Oregon's economy thrives.
Are you describing some version of, a reduction in income taxes and that would be combined with an increase in sort of carbon-based goods?
Not at this point, no. But I will say the proposal that was on the table, the cap and invest proposal that was on the table, I think helps tackle some of the economic justice issues that you typically see in taxing strategies.
So this is yet another area where you're talking about work 2 years from now. There's a big change that's going to happen, though, which is that there's going to be another election for governor. I mean, are you saying now that you are going to run for governor in under 2 years?
Well, at this point in time, I'm focused on governing. The legislative session just finished less than a week ago. We're still reviewing bills, word for word and comma by comma. My legal team is doing that. And obviously getting ready for the February 18 legislative session. And so my focus right now is on making sure that Oregon is thriving and that state government is running more effectively and efficiently.
But you are talking about, I mean, your words were setting the table for the next big session, next long session. I mean, it seems like it would only make sense to set the table if you were going to be the governor.
I actually disagree. I think the groundwork that we can lay right now over the next 18 months is significant to, I use the sports analogy, to moving the football down the field.
Even if somebody else is carrying the ball at that
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking right now with Oregon Governor Kate Brown. We're coming to you from Salem. You talked about some of the initiatives that you're proud of, in particular the transportation package. What's the big one for you that got away, the initiative that you were most passionate about that you couldn't get done?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about revenue reform. I spent significant time meeting with business organizations around the state, meeting with individual folks in communities around the state, trying to figure out a way if we could build consensus around a revenue package. My team, I had several members of my team working on that as well. We were also working with members of the legislature to see if we could get agreement on a package, and we were unsuccessful in doing that. But we're going to keep trying. We're going to keep fighting on that. I think there were a couple of pieces that I was disappointed in. Number one, Cleaner Air Oregon. We were unable to raise the fees on polluter pays this session. But I have hope in the fact that the business community has come to the table and that we have continued funding for the program to connect health with environmental regulations.
Just so I understand what that would have done. My understanding is it would have, that money would have paid for a new DEQ analysis to figure out new rules for industrial polluters and factories. That didn't happen. Does that mean that you can get money from other pots to actually rethink and sort of modernize the way the state regulates air?
The fee did not happen, but we were able to move. We are going to move forward with the program, and the answer is yes. So we will move forward with the regulatory reforms. Department of Environmental Quality is working with the business community, with the environmental community, and with the scientific community to make sure that we're doing this in a way that makes sense and protects people's health, both in the workplace and in the surrounding communities.
Do you think that the fact that didn't pass this year, that particular, you know, forcing companies to pay more into it, that has to do with the time that's passed since this was in the news? I mean, it was last year when Portlanders in particular were seeing all of this news about heavy metals, and there was the Forest Service study that looked at the moss and found people worried about, you know, can I eat vegetables from my garden? It was only a year ago, but it was a full year ago. I mean, in your mind, is that time difference the difference it takes to have a bill like this that you would champion not pass?
Possibly, yes. But I think there's certainly other factors in terms of environmental issues that we were fighting for here in Salem. One of my, what I think is a significant environmental win, is keeping the Elliott Forest in public hands. And my team and I spent a lot of time and energy fighting to make that happen. You might recall at the land board meeting in February, I was sort of short, shall we say, two votes. And it took us several weeks of working with folks to get the votes we needed to keep the Elliott in public hands. And then to produce the funding for that also took some cajoling and some arm twisting. So that took a lot of time and energy. I think it was time and energy well spent to keep the Elliott Forest in public hands for future generations.
This reminds me of another priority or idea you've put forward, which is to come up with a list of state-owned properties that could be sold off to reduce the unfunded liability for PERS, not including things like the Elliott State Forest. State Forest would not be included. Where does that stand?
So there are two things that I took off the table. One is state forests, and the other is privatization of prisons. After that, everything else is on the table. The group will start meeting in August. They're due to have a report to me by November. I am hoping that they will have concrete suggestions. If there needs to be statutory changes, that they will be ready for the February session.
Do you have a sense for how much money could be gotten in a one-time lump by selling off? I'm not even quite sure if it's unused parking lots or an old depot for gravel from ODOT, various kinds of state properties. How much money is there?
We don't know the answer to that, and that's why we've put these certified smart folks at the table to tackle this. My goal is to move PERS to 90% stabilization. That means finding in the neighborhood of $5 to $7 billion. That's a lot of money. But I will tell you, in Senate Bill 1067, we were able to set aside, with some other actions that we took, up to $500 million already to buy down the PERS unfunded actuarial liability. And the reason why this is important is because that will enable us to reduce employer rates. So it's key in terms of getting more money into the classrooms, getting more money into key basic services like foster care and services for seniors.
You talked about the possibility of having to call a special session depending on what Congress might do in terms of health care in particular. So that's one big area where there's a huge question mark about what might happen in D.C. What else are you paying attention to from Congress or from the Trump administration that you think could affect your decision-making in the coming months?
So, and I just want to go back to your question about other disappointments and legislative sessions.
Rarely do people want to go back to a question about disappointments.
Well, I think it's important because rarely have I ever been through a legislative session where I've got 100% of what I want. It's a process of incrementalism. And I remember being in the minority for 14 years in this building. I was happy to get a portion of a heel of a bread, a loaf of bread. The other concern, the other disappointment for me was in our inability to move forward on closing the Charleston loophole. We were not able to get that through the Senate.
And that allows people to buy a gun even if the answer hasn't come back from a background check.
Yes, yes. What we were able to do is pass the Extreme Risk Protection Order, a bill that will enable judges to take guns out of the hands of people who might be a danger to themselves or others. That is a good thing, but not being able to get the Charleston loophole closed was really disappointing for me.
So on to Congress.
In terms of focus at the federal level, my work with or against the administration, depending upon your perspective, has been basically in three areas: around health care, around immigration, and around the environment. And in terms of health care, we have been fighting vociferously against the federal attempts, the Trump administration attempts, to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And the reason why I am opposed to that and leading the charge here from Oregon with the help of folks at Oregon Health Authority and Department of Consumer and Business Services is that with the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan, we were able to add over 340,000 Oregonians to the Oregon Health Plan. People like Brandy and her children, she has a young child who has cystic fibrosis, and the child's medication costs that family family more than $55,000 a year alone. So it's significant. It has really helped families thrive. The second piece, though, is the job creation. With the expansion, we've created over 23,000 jobs across the state. We know that a repeal will have devastating impacts, both in terms of kicking hundreds of thousands of Oregonians off the Oregon Health Plan, and in terms of job, it will cost us jobs, significant jobs in rural Oregon and significant jobs in urban Oregon.
You talked about your experience earlier in this building when you were in the minority, or at least partly in the minority, because at that time there was still Democratic governors. Now it's pretty solidly controlled by your party. I mean, Republicans talk about one-party rule, and they say that ruefully or angrily or unhappily. In your mind, is one-party rule good for Oregon?
Here's what I will say. We've been able to move forward on a number of the priorities I had for the legislative session, including balancing the budget, which is significant.
Which you have no choice. You have to do
that. You have to do it. But I look to Washington, right? They had three special sessions. Illinois wrestled with two years with no budget. I know Pennsylvania's wrestled. A number of states have wrestled. We were able to balance the budget in a way that reflects the priorities of rural and urban Oregon. We expanded access to health care. Not only did we continue funding for the Oregon Health Plan, which required a bipartisan vote, but we were able to expand access to health care by enabling every single Oregon child now to have health care coverage. And we did it in a bipartisan way. That is significant. I talked about the transportation package. That was definitely a collaborative bipartisan effort. And the cost containment, while the votes were primarily Democratic votes, Senate Bill 1067. That was the work of a bipartisan work group, including folks like Representative Greg Smith, Senator Betsy Johnson. This bill was based on their work. So many of the significant pieces of legislation that we passed were done in a bipartisan way, and Oregonians should be very proud of that.
Governor Kate Brown, thanks very much. That is the end. Thank you.
That's the end?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
The end of the hour is here.
Thank you. Time flies.
It does.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Tomorrow on the show, it's a special edition of our show. We spent a day at the Central Branch of the Multnomah County Library recently. We're going to bring you the stories of patrons, librarians, people who work behind the scenes, even the resident social worker. Thanks very much for tuning in today. I'm Dave Miller. We will join you tomorrow.
Support for Think Out Loud is provided by the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust and Ray and Marilyn Johnson.